Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Right, there we go. Welcome all. So, if you could please just first introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your interests and how you came together, how you came to study food gentrification, and sort of the genesis of this book.
So one of the things that we wanted to be mindful in putting the edited volume together was to feature different types of cities. But at the same time, we also recognized that there were different aspects of gentrification. And so we ended up putting the volume together in ways that the first half of the book is about how food is used as a tool of gentrification, whether intentionally or not. And then the second half of the volume became the situation where the food was used as a framework in place for the activists to push back against gentrification and impact of gentrification. So that was one of the things that we began to see based on the proposal for the chapters that we received. And we also wanted to feature scholars of different experiences. So there were some graduate students who I think are almost ready to defend. I think one of them just recently defended their dissertation, and then other scholars who are pretty well established in the discipline. And so we wanted to bring all those folks together who at that point may have been reading each other's work, but really didn't have a place to collaborate. So those are sort of a few things that I think went into our discussion about how to organize the chapters.
And I just remember like getting all the chapter submissions and they were just abstracts. And then Yuki and Josh and I were all on a Zoom or a call or whatever it was together. And we were talking about, you know, we were kind of coding them almost like you would code qualitative data of being like, okay, you know, what city is it? Because we got like, you know, for example, we got several submissions on LA. We got several submissions on the Bay Area. We got several submissions on New York, and we had to ask the New York chapter actually was a product of us saying, okay, you guys all know each other and you're all writing about this in New York and you're all writing about community gardens. You are now one chapter. Can you write it together? So some of it was trying to be inclusive in that way. And then also see like, how could we make things fit together? And so coding them by city, coding them by, you know, are they about urban ag or are they about restaurants or are they about grocery stores, coding them by, are they about, you know, resistance to gentrification from food activists or are they about development and food activists kind of being affected by the development of the city and the gentrification of the city? Or are they about food activists playing a role in and kind of inviting in the development and the gentrification of the city? And so we were just trying to make sure we told different kinds of stories or different parts of what we see as sometimes one whole story from different cities by different scholars and at different stages of their career. Because I also, like Yuki was saying, you know, I think it's really important when you do an edited volume to make sure you have some folks that are in the early stages of their career. Because first of all, like, they are doing in some ways the most cutting edge work. They're often the most embedded in community organizations and the most focused on the perspectives of the people that they're working with. And also, I just think it's really important to make sure that that we're here, you know, that they're part of the larger conversation, that we're not just hearing from the same people over and over again, that we're constantly figuring out how new folks are driving the conversation forward.
Yeah, thank you. Josh, any final thoughts on that?
No, that was covered really well.
Excellent. So something that I noticed wasn't a heavily featured topic in the collection is the idea of food deserts. As I mentioned to you in the email that I sent out, I was working at Whole Foods in grad school at the time. This is, you know, about 10, 11 years ago. And I remember, and of course, so this is the pre-Amazon purchase. And I remember we had a store announcement. Everyone was really excited that they were going to be putting a new store in downtown Detroit. And so I always wonder about those types of moves, just because, you know, of course, you hear all the jokes about how expensive Whole Foods is. And so all of the people on the, like all the employees, you know, we were all concerned, okay, so are people in the area who obviously need a grocery store because it's right in where the store was going, was right in the middle of a food desert. Are the people in that area actually going to be able to benefit from that type of store? Because, you know, are they going to be priced out of shopping there? And of course, then once there's a Whole Foods, as you all mentioned in the introduction of your book, for example, once that sort of one new hip thing comes in, that starts to draw other types of gentrifiers and other new residents, as you talk about in your book. So I'm just curious on your thoughts on that. And then also, it kind of reminds me of the discussion of savior entrepreneurs who, you know, often don't see their contribution to gentrification. So I'm curious if you see parallels between gentrification and this particular type of move, which John Mackey called conscious capitalism. So, you know, either your thoughts on conscious capitalism, your thoughts on the savior entrepreneurs, and if you see any parallels between those types of behaviors when it comes to gentrification and food deserts and, you know, sort of supporting the community in those ways.
Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack, and I hope we have some time here to get into it. So I think one of the first things that, you know, I would note is that in thinking about communities that have low access to a large scale grocery store or a lack of access to healthy and affordable food, usually that's one social condition among many in either a working class or a low income community that experiences, for instance, poor infrastructure, heavy policing, not as quality schools, not as quality housing stock. And so there's sort of a battery of social problems, if you will, facing communities that also happen to have a lack of access to good food. And what's interesting in thinking about the trajectory of gentrification is that in a lot of these communities, there's a racialized process of dispossession and disinvestment that has created the conditions under which there's low food access. And that at some point, those neighborhoods, especially in cities, become attractive for whatever reason, low ground rents, for instance, for artists or other potential newcomers who, quote unquote, discover these neighborhoods. And so there's a relationship between those communities that lack food access and then the process of capitalist development within cities. You know, cities need to find neighborhoods to continue to invest capital to grow. And food businesses become one of the means through which that happens. And at a later stage of gentrification, you might see something like a Whole Foods, but that's going to be likely at a much later stage. Earlier on might be a cafe or something of that sort. In a company like Whole Foods, they're notorious for actually not siting their grocery stores in communities that have the greatest needs. They're looking for communities that have quote unquote upward mobility and greater capital to spend. And so the strategy of placing a Whole Foods oftentimes is in fact a strategy for gentrification. And it may be couched as, oh, look, we're gonna now serve a community that doesn't lack access to much food, but you know, usually that's much later on. So yeah, the notion of conscious capitalism, you know, it's just a way to grow capital. You know, it's a market-based solution to justify itself.
Yeah, absolutely. You here, Allison, do you have thoughts on that as well?
I mean, I think we have to ask, when we think conscious capitalism, we have to say conscious of what, right? Conscious capitalism tends not to acknowledge things like racialized dispossession and all of the kind of deep history that Josh was going through that is implicated in, if not completely responsible, for the creation of so-called food deserts. And so this idea that we could have profit, that we could have solutions to racialized dispossession that would also create profit for shareholders is, it's just not true, right? The evidence just doesn't bear it out. And so while they may be able to do some things that seem more conscious, like sell more organic food, which is great, right? But it's not enough to address the kinds of problems that we're seeing. And in fact, I think the way that this book really adds to the critique of conscious capitalism that's kind of runs through the literature on food justice and alternative food systems more generally is that it really adds that not only does it not solve the problem, but in some ways it makes the problem worse, right? Because these conscious capitalist food businesses, whether they're Whole Foods or the kinds of savior entrepreneurs that that Nina Shankar wrote about in the chapter on Durham, they come into communities that are struggling. And then not only do they not address the needs of the people who are already there, right? If you live in a neighborhood with no grocery store because of this long history of racialized dispossession and Whole Foods opens down the block from you, you probably still can't afford to shop at Whole Foods, right? So not only does it not solve the problem, but in some ways the unintended or intended consequences of these moves in terms of being lures for new people and other kinds of development actually makes the problem worse, because now not only are you in a neighborhood that lacks basic services and basic amenities, but you're in a neighborhood that lacks basic services and amenities that you can afford, and the rent is going up, right? So I think one of the things our book really does to extend the discussion is talks about, like, not only does kind of the good food movement not address the problems at hand for these communities that are struggling with issues of racialized dispossession, with redlining, with poverty more generally, with underemployment, with over-policing, right? The whole picture, right? But it actually contributes to something that makes these people's lives even harder.
Thank you. Yeah. Yuki, did you have thoughts on that?
Sure. I think both Josh and Ali did an excellent job of sort of highlighting what our the editor volume contribute to this conversation. And I think one of the things that we tend to not see as much in gentrification conversation is really who's actually making the call. And so oftentimes we certainly see the most I guess, embodied a representation of gentrification might be individual, you know, renters or new homeowners in the neighborhood, or perhaps new businesses that open up, and we can point a finger at that, you know, you are gentrifying the neighborhood. And I think that is certainly something to discuss. But I also think that we often make it seem as though these individual renters, or I mean, get residents or the businesses somehow, you know, randomly, coincidentally, all showed up in the same part of the town of this particular city. And I think this is where we also need to think about what's enabling this kind of investment. And cities, or even states, but particularly I think at a local level, cities actually do selectively give incentive and even encourage these type of businesses to open, rather than, you know, so Whole Foods has much easier time negotiating their location, you know, of new retail in some neighborhood than perhaps smaller grocery store. And in all of this, I think what our volume also wanted the readers to think about is to think about what is really actually, you know, making, I guess, the forces that are enabling these capitalistic reinvestment in the city, and who gets to be, you know, at the table for these conversations. So it's not just that the Whole Foods are out of economic range of a lot of the residents in these neighborhood that have historically been underinvested, but it's really that they were never really often time given opportunity to give their input, or if they try to give an input, their voices are not heard. And so even though perhaps some of these, you know, savior entrepreneurs or conscious capitalists may feel that they are trying to solve a problem, but oftentimes they're not really asking very important first question. What is the problem from your vantage point? You know, what is the solution that you would like to see in your community? And instead, they have their own ideas of what the problem is, how they're going to solve it. And oftentimes that also then end up reinforcing the existing problem and making it worse.
Yeah, that's absolutely a great point. I think, and you talk, I think throughout the book, I think there's discussion of, you know, the idea that the people who live there, the people who are going to be most affected by this, are not consulted, are not asked, are not considered. And something that Allison mentioned in her answer just now, she was talking about good food movements, which actually kind of brings me to my next question. And as I had mentioned in the email, this might have felt tangential to you, but just a little background. So I live in Cincinnati, and right around the college, the University of Cincinnati, when I was growing up in high school and in college, it was the university was right in the middle of a really depressed, an economically depressed part of town. And then about 20 years ago, they started sort of building it up a little bit more. And this is when a lot of, you know, one of the things that sort of a recurring theme in the book was this notion of authenticity, right? So, you know, these restaurants that were sort of striving to get at the authentic feel of what foods were happening already in the neighborhood, what foods were popular in the neighborhood, what foods were culturally consumed in that neighborhood traditionally. And so we saw a lot of that, a lot of sort of new residents coming in and trying to recapture these authentic food styles. But now all of that is gone. So these days, what's there now are, you know, gastropubs and vegan restaurants and restaurants that sort of cater to fad diets or lifestyle eating or even good food movements, that kind of thing. And so I'm kind of curious, you know, sort of contrasted to the notion of authenticity, have you found in your research that the push for authenticity from new residents in gentrifying areas is typically a temporary one? So in other words, do new, quote, authentic restaurants and other eateries lose popularity or change menus once gentrification is more fully established? So like, is that notion of chasing authenticity more about getting people in, or is it something that you've seen tends to stick around?
Yeah, I can say something about that, but then I want to hand it over to Yuki because she's the resident urbanist here. So when scholars study gentrification, they often talk about it in stages, and that's a little bit false because it's not like things can't go back and forth, but it tends to happen where there are phases of early gentrification, which tends to be like, you know, kind of artists and entrepreneurs and kind of, you know, what gets called the creative class, which is a phrase that I hate because lots of kinds of people are creative in very different ways. The idea that some people are creative and some people are not is not my favorite thing. But that eventually those people, and I'm not totally clear on kind of the order of things, but those folks end up coming into a neighborhood and either signaling to developers that this is a place that's ripe for large scale capitalist development. And then you have the early gentrifiers being basically pushed out by large scale capital. You see a lot more like new build gentrification where everything gets knocked down and there's just these like, you know, apartment buildings that kind of look the same as everything else. And the food landscape that you were describing, Aubrey, where like all of a sudden, instead of all these kind of funky and interesting places and people who are trying all kinds of different things, it's like 10 million gastropubs, right? And it doesn't, and all of those gastropubs, while they might be chef driven, have teams of investors behind them and are part of these like big restaurant groups where it's really being driven by large scale capitalist investment and not necessarily like an individual entrepreneur at the helm. And so it starts to feel a little bit like that same McDonaldized world that in some ways I feel like the move among young folks to get back into cities was like a reaction to the kind of the McDonaldization of suburbia, right? And so cities were where people were looking for something more authentic and funky and interesting. And capitalism has basically taken that instinct and smoothed it over in a way where now it looks the same, you know, where a way in where downtown, you know, I was in downtown Oklahoma City over the summer, and it doesn't look and feel that different from lots of downtowns in the Bay Area. I was literally in a brewery called Social Capital. Which of course I sent Josh and Yuki pictures of because it's too good not to share. But this idea that like any of the kind of artistic impulse behind early gentrification, that quest for authenticity, that quest for something that feels kind of vibrant and meaningful, it doesn't survive the influx of large scale capitalism that it brings with it.
I think that, I think Ali pointed out a few very, important issues relating to this conversation around authenticity. And I think we need to sort of pause and ask, what is authenticity? You know, authentic to whom? And why, in what way is it valuable? And so I think in many ways, what happens in cities that are going through redevelopment is that the conception of authenticity through the eyes of the people with economic resources are the one that become the dominant definition of authenticity, not the authentic way of life or particularly food ways of the people who have created a very unique way of expressing their culture or perhaps also representing their histories and identity through food. And so I do think that, you know, when we talk about does the sort of a focus on authenticity come and go, I think it's more about what version of authenticity, you know, is valorized in that particular point in gentrification. Because I think there are moments, kind of a brief moment, I think as Ali was kind of a, and I think Josh earlier were pointing to the sort of a different stages and pace of gentrification. And I do agree with Ali that it's not a linear progression necessarily, or that it all happens in the same stages or same pace. And but I do think that there is a point where the kind of a greediness, I think Sharon Zukin talks about this in several of her work on gentrification, about the sort of a, you know, appeal of greediness. I think Derek Hyera also called this sort of a, you know, appeal of the kind of the authenticity of others. But I think oftentimes people who are moving into this neighborhood also don't want it to be too authentic, right? So they want it to be authentic enough to their feeling of getting something different or something unique, but also comfortable to their taste. So I think that's oftentimes how businesses kind of calibrate, you know, what was the right balance of, you know, representing symbolically or realistically the authentic culture and history of the place without scaring those new customers away. And I think this happens not just with the new businesses, but also I think the long-term businesses adapting to the newcomers. So I think it's sort of, again, it's a kind of an interesting negotiation processes. I think realistically, the reason why some of these long-term businesses leave is because of the changes in rent and also, you know, their inability to, their lack of capacity to compete with other restaurateurs that are able to, you know, secure the business licenses and be able to keep up with the rising property value in the area. And so I think that's probably what mostly drives who gets to open the business. And I think the consumer's taste will come and go constantly, but I don't think that's necessarily the only thing that's driving whose business is thriving in particular neighborhood.
So then do you think that then related to this notion of authenticity, do you think people chase it? I mean, do you think so once, you know, the capitalists come in and sort of take over and, you know, you can't find those sort of, and again, of course, we're always using authenticity in quotes, because as Yuki pointed out, you know, who is it authentic for? Who decides that, et cetera? So I'm curious. Do you think that that's connected to gentrification? I mean, do you think people chase authenticity? So we can't find it in this neighborhood anymore. So now we're going to go try to find it in this other neighborhood. I mean, do you think that happens?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, I think there's definitely culinary tourism, and it can happen within a city, or it can among residents that actually live in that city, or it can happen with sort of a determination on the part of an individual who's traveling somewhere outside of the city that they live in to experience some kind of culinary delight. And I think when we're talking about this notion of authentic, it's not the only thing that people chase. They're chasing tastes of various kinds. And, you know, if you think of like the history of the production of taste, you know, at one point people were chasing high-end French restaurants because that was a way to signal a form of distinction and class above other kinds of eaters or eating maybe meat and potatoes, right? And so in thinking about the relationship between food and gentrification, in terms of kind of paying attention to what's going on, there's likely going to be new food trends that emerge, and people are going to want to visit those parts of a city that are able to meet those evolving tastes that signal some form of distinction. Now, whether to the question of it contributing directly to gentrification, you know, it's not the purchase of food per se at a restaurant that's leading to gentrification, you know, it's the increasing ground rents. So if you have enough people frequenting a business that maybe is not originally from the neighborhood, and you know, a person that owns that land is able to charge more rent to that company versus say a local business that isn't selling as many food products to incomers, then they're going to get outcompeted. And that process is what can perhaps create gentrification in the food landscape itself. So excluding housing for a moment. And we haven't really talked much about that process, but that's also something that happens is, you know, through this kind of culinary tourism, you can see a gentrification of the foodscape, which may not have ramifications for the housing market, although it may, for whatever reason, people are also interested in that neighborhood for other kinds of amenities or possibilities that are available there. So, yeah, I'm thinking about this chasing authentic, you know, I'm kind of curious also about chasing all kinds of food trends and what that portends for gentrification of the foodscape itself.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up food tourism, actually, because I was interested in that as well in terms of like cultural or class tourism. So, for example, these notions of like, so in From the Holy Trinity to Microgreens, the author mentions, quote, reinterpreted Cajun or Creole dishes, appealing to the foodies in search of the new iteration of authenticity and exoticism. That was on page 119 of the text. So it sort of seems like an opportunity to dabble in the lives and cultures of the people being displaced, right, without having to actually navigate those same lived experiences. And so I'm curious what everyone's thoughts are on that, sort of that notion of cultural and class tourism that happens when, you know, so the food is already there, but then, you know, a neighborhood starts to be gentrified and then people are bringing in these, you know, sort of quote unquote authentic, but then also reinterpretations, right, of this food that is supposedly authentic to the area. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are, what everyone's thoughts are on, you know, sort of that notion of cultural or class tourism in that way.
So I think that was the chapter that I wrote with Pam Broom on New Orleans. And there's actually a really great book called Authentic New Orleans by Kevin Gotham about the tourism industry in New Orleans and how it created this notion of authentic New Orleans precisely for tourism. And I think it's important for us to recognize that that's not a new thing. It's always been part of the cities, particularly the cities that rely on tourism to define and perform authenticity in a particular way that appeal to the tourist and what they're willing to, I guess, pay money to come see. I think that's, that said, I think a few things that are problematic with that. Oftentimes, the kind of authentic culture that the places love to market are not that are of people who have been marginalized within those places. Yet at the same time, so then they are least likely to benefit from the commodification of their authentic culture. This is precisely the case in New Orleans, whether it's music or food or not so much architecture maybe, but a lot of the street culture of New Orleans has been highly commodified as a way to bring tourists in from outside. And so these are really meant to be for the outsiders. Yet at the same time, I think there's been some recognition of that in many of these cities where local activists are trying to take back that narrative and to look for ways to not only economically but also socially reclaim their own ownership of these cultures. So I think that's something that is happening in many cities, including in New Orleans. But I also think that in terms of the tourism, authenticity in food, I think what Ali mentioned earlier in terms of kind of McDonaldization or flattening of the food culture across places, I think this is really kind of an interesting, perhaps unfortunate outcome of, you know, every place having similar kind of twist on whatever local, you know, cuisine, and they all start to look the same. And so then they have to keep looking for ways to perhaps reinvent themselves. And perhaps at some point, authenticity does not really become the most common ways to market a place. You know, they could be something else. And so in all of that, though, I think from our vantage point, as we were putting the editor volume together, what happens as a result of that is the loss of the memory of the people who created a very unique culture and history of the place, on which the capital reinvestment was activate it, and they are no longer going to be there to benefit from that. So I think that's really is the process I think that we are problematizing. But I don't think this is not something that is is brand new. I think it's always been the case in many cities. I think it's just that it's happening in so many different cities as we feature so many smaller towns or cities that are undergoing gentrification. And so it used to perhaps be, you know, New York, New Orleans, and sort of a relatively bigger, older cities. But now those kind of processes are happening at the smaller scale. I think that's really where we see the difference in, contemporary iteration of those trends.
Josh or Allison, did either of you have thoughts on that?
I think that was great. I also just talked before Yuki, so Josh, if you have anything to add.
Yeah, the only thing that actually comes to mind are differences in class within a particular ethno-racial group. And the reason that I bring that up, I just read this book by Joseph Iwudzi Jr. called Getting Something to Eat in Jackson. And Jackson is a majority Black city. It's one of the highest concentrations of African Americans in the United States. And he tells the story in this book about a couple that owns a barbecue restaurant in a part of Jackson that is working class and overwhelmingly a Black part of the city, and talks about the experience of these business owners wanting to create this kind of barbecue that they find is unique and that they're inspired to make as chefs, and that local residents, local Black residents in this neighborhood who frequent this place, many will come in looking for more typical soul food items. And that this restaurant will also occasionally get the random white person coming from another part of town to eat this barbecue. And in Woodsy gets into the challenges that certain food business owners face in who do they appeal to, and how do they survive economically? You know, if their local community, like the ethno-racial group that they come from, isn't finding what's being created to the tastes of that group, you know, do you start to then tailor your cooking to another group? And what he gets into is the complications of land rent, and the fact that the reason that this barbecue restaurant is in this neighborhood is because they can't afford to be in a wealthier part of town. And so all these things kind of come together in getting me to kind of think about also the way in which class refracts through different ethno-racial groups and the kind of the demographic makeup of neighborhoods within a city. And it, for me, really complicated how I thought about who gets to claim authentic and where do pressures for authenticity come from, and how do they abut economic pressures and a desire to perhaps do something different than what you might be pigeonholed into otherwise.
And I just want to add that I learned about that book because I listened to an interview with the author on the New Books Network, the sociology podcast. And so I was really excited to listen to the interview with the author. And now Josh is making me want to go back and read the rest of the book.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Okay, so then I guess my last question was seeing patterns of appropriation. So I noticed, and it wasn't really sort of explicitly talked about, but, you know, of course, you know, coming at this from an anthropological perspective, you know, I'm sort of always focusing on the culture aspect of things. So I saw a lot of patterns of appropriation. So for example, several authors mentioned the use of existing urban farms and community gardens that belong to or are shared by established residents as a mean of selling the areas to potential new residents. And I can't remember which of you brought that up at the beginning of the interview, but I know somebody brought it up at the beginning of the interview. And so one of your authors, Brooke Havlick, discusses the parallels between savior entrepreneurs and colonizers and the quote, nothing there narrative. And throughout the text, authenticity is written in quotation marks. And we've talked a little bit about authenticity and, you know, again, who gets to define it, who gets to determine it, who is it for, that kind of thing. But it also sort of points to the intangible, the often intangible means of determining authenticity. So on the one hand, we see the appropriation of community spaces. And then once new residents move in, we see the appropriation of authentic foods and authenticity and authentic culture and things like that. So I'm curious about what your experiences were with this as researchers in your various sites.
So one of the things that comes to mind in thinking about space and thinking about who gets to control space in a city, and when we're talking about food and food production, you know, these are things that are really central to the need to survive for many people that live in cities. And in looking at Denver, for example, a case that I'm really familiar with, you know, one of the ways in which communities were able to claim access to space was not so much a claim to kind of their authenticity as a particular group, but more a claim to be engaging in a practice that was socially and politically palatable. And specifically, I'm referring to local food and the local phenomena and local food production. And I think that discourse, especially among planners and among what we might call the urban growth machine, has really opened up a lot of space for all kinds of different groups across ethno-racial and class spectrums to make claims to the city in various kinds of ways. But what happens is that because of the different class positioning of groups, people have different power to be able to actually claim and then hold on to space. And in the case of Denver, for example, you know, there have been efforts to grow food, and then farmers that are on that land can no longer afford to stay on that land, and that land gets upscaled and sold to developers who then use that branding of local. I talk specifically in the book about a case called Spark Development that was built on what was formerly called Sustainability Park, where there was a bunch of urban agriculture. And, you know, these groups that were growing food, you know, were well-meaning farmers, and many of them were working to solve issues of food insecurity and try to get food into the mouths of people that needed it most. And ultimately, the development that came instead built a giant capital-intensive hydroponic farming operation on top of a James Beard Award-winning chef Japanese restaurant. And so there's kind of this struggle over land and who gets to claim being local too. And, you know, the question that I ask is, you know, local for who and local how? You know, how are we getting that food that's local to people, and who gets to actually grow that local food, who has access to the land to do that?
I was thinking about Ashanti Reese's Black Food Geography. There are several chapters where she talks about Deanwood neighborhood in DC, where I live now, where there is a perception by a lot of the other folks outside of the community in DC, and particularly I think policymakers of the city, this idea of there's nothing there. I think that is obviously the perspective of the folks with certain expectations about what is the appropriate amenity for a community, and then also perhaps what counts as the resources in the community. And I think what's really fascinating in her book is she talks about the strength and sort of a communal mechanism that the residents actually developed as a way to deal with the fact that certainly they lack access to fully stocked grocery stores that are not even affordable, just in general. There is just really one grocery store to this day in that part of town. I think I think this idea of there is nothing there also, you know, coming back to this kind of concept of food desert that I think we're increasingly problematizing in food justice scholarship, is this idea that that we are labeling places where there is a lot of resources and ways of making things work, and people are working to counter those things. And I think it just really calling a place food desert, or that there is nothing there, also not only is inaccurate, but also I think really kind of feeds into this idea of powerless people who just are waiting for help. And I do think that that needs to be countered as well. And I think a lot of activists are very much countering that. And I think during the early months of the pandemic, I think these communities actually had a lot of very visible work among the residents who came together as a mutual aid, and sort of building on the strength that they had already cultivated over the years. And I think it was really an interesting, I think, moment for the outsider to recognize that these are not places where people are just helplessly waiting for help, but or have always been actively empowering themselves. It's just that the forces from outside to continuously undermine their effort, I think, has been so powerful. And so I think that's something that we should also remember in connection to discussion of gentrification, to not treat those places as there was nothing there before, or that, you know, people there weren't doing anything in that process. Oftentimes those communities do fight back. It's just that their forces are not economically or politically influential enough in a local or, I guess, national space to push back against investment capital.
That was really well done, Yuki. Rather than follow that directly, I kind of want to push back on something Aubrey asked about earlier, which is that there's not that much written about food deserts in this book. And I think that we are collectively, like not just the three of us, but the authors in this book, were kind of wary of the terminology debate around, you know, the problematic nature of calling somebody else's neighborhood a desert. First of all, deserts are natural, deserts are teeming with life. But of course, that's not what the metaphor of a food desert is supposed to say. Activists often use the phrase food apartheid, which I respect and like for the stridentness of it, and for the starkness of it. But I also worry about, you know, the idea of apartheid being so state driven. And while the state is certainly like implicated in all of these deep processes that Josh talked about earlier in terms of how neighborhoods came to look the way they do, I think we're talking about something that is both state-enabled and capitalist at the same time. So I'm not personally 100% comfortable with the idea of food apartheid either, though I also feel like activists should get to choose what they want to call the situation they find themselves in. One of my favorite things ever written about the idea of food deserts is actually in our book. It's in Annalena Hasberg's chapter, and she talks about how food desert as a noun is problematic, but she likes the idea of it as a verb. So these places have been food deserted, in that food businesses that were there have either had to shutter because of forces like redlining and urban renewal and, you know, and violence, right? There were grocery stores in Tulsa before it was burned to the ground, right? There, you know, so violence is also a reason that there have not been community based grocery stores, but then also the capitalist forces of kind of the major chains, you know, wanting to be in the suburbs because of square footage and economies of scale, and also perceptions of who they want their clientele to be and who they don't want their clientele to be, which is, you know, maybe not explicitly part of how they choose their locations, but I think implicitly is certainly part of the equation. You know, race is part of how we come to value land differently. That matters for food stores, and it matters for housing, and it matters for all of these other social processes. So this idea that these neighborhoods have been food deserted really strikes really rang a bell with me. I thought it was really and Annalena is such a eloquent writer, and so I really loved that. And I also want to bring up a piece that I don't know if it's out yet, but it's written by Justin Myers, and who's also one of our chapter authors. He's one of the co-authors in the chapter on community gardens in New York City, and he has a piece where he talks about how the food desert phenomenon, like not the idea that communities lack access to places to buy food, but that people have started kind of talking about and problematizing food deserts, and that the problem has become defined as the lack of grocery stores and not the kind of broader racialized underdevelopment that is responsible for it. He is theorizing that that may be itself an outgrowth of gentrification, where young early gentrifiers move into these underdeveloped communities, and what is problematic for them is the lack of a grocery store, right? And so this is something I experienced in West Oakland, like when I started doing research there in the early 2000s, is that there were people who had lived in that community for a long time that thought that not having a grocery store in their neighborhood was problematic. Like that was absolutely true. But there were also lots of newcomers who came in as interns for places like People's Grocery and City Slicker Farms, and who were there and also were just kind of young artists who were getting pushed out of San Francisco and living in warehouses and doing all the things that people were doing in Oakland in the early 2000s. And for those folks, the lack of a grocery store was a serious problem. And maybe the over-policing of Black and brown people was not as much of a problem for them, because that meant they could throw warehouse parties and get away with it because the police were busy with other things. And so I wonder sometimes if gentrification is actually even, and this is what Justin is wondering in his piece, if gentrification is actually even more implicated in the problematization of food deserts than we've previously thought, because early gentrifiers were a part of this conversation about why food deserts were a problem and how we have to address them by, having alternative food systems and also grocery stores. From the moment where these conversations became more prominent than other kinds of problems in these neighborhoods. And so having early gentrifiers be parts of those conversations gave it like a level of national prominence that, in this moment in the early 2000s, people weren't talking about defunding the police. People weren't talking about other kind of longer term or maybe not longer term, but other also substantial issues in these communities.
Yeah, thank you for that. Absolutely. As I had mentioned to all of you, I am new myself to food studies, and I find that an intriguing argument, that notion that sort of this idea, well, and it ties into the savior complex, right? So this notion that we have to go in and fix these areas, but then of course, the notions about what's quote wrong in an area are not going to be agreed upon, right, between developers and current residents. And so I think that's probably also true, as you're all pointing out, with that notion of food deserts, and then why, of course, that term is problematic. And so I appreciate that, because that's something I hadn't considered myself before. So I will be looking for that. The Justin Meyer, is that a new book or an article, or?
It's an article he's working on, and I know it was going through review at one point, and I don't know kind of where it is in that process.
I appreciate you both of you bringing that up. Do any of you have any final thoughts on the book, on gentrification, on gentrification of foodways, et cetera?
We have had a conversation or two over the last year and a half or so, or almost 2 years now, about the impact of the pandemic on this kind of a intersection between food and gentrification. And it seems that on one hand, I think gentrification has, if anything, accelerated in a lot of places, and particularly in places where maybe there was already a sign of it, but now there is sort of a much larger scale of gentrification happening. And it seems that in a lot of those places, local resident activists, and I guess also developers, are really honing in on the role that the food plays in that process. And so I hope that we are hoping to kind of continue this conversation, and we're hoping that this edited volume gives folks some place to start in and engaging in those conversations.
Josh or Allison?
I just want to add that we're continuing to think through these conversations. Like, first of all, as the book, you know, comes out and people read it, there's all kinds of conversations we get into about what is in the book, what's not in the book, including this one. But that we're also working on a chapter for a book on radical food geographies that's being put out in the next couple of years, and that we're going to have a chance to really, and our chapter is going to really focus on how the pandemic has changed and in some ways amplified the kinds of dynamics that we were writing about in the book. And so it'll be a way for us to kind of continue this conversation.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the one thing that I would like to end on is the fact that a lot of people are resisting, a lot of people are resisting gentrification. And we write about that resistance in our book, and, you know, the complications of organizing against gentrification through food in a context where food is valorized and used to actually gentrify cities. And so there's sort of this built-in contradiction that a lot of activists face that are doing food justice work in particular. But I think that there's this greater recognition among many activists on the left, at least, that there's a need to think much more intersectionally and bridge between different kinds of social movements if we're going to have more equitable cities. That, you know, the fight for food justice is also a fight against gentrification. You know, that the fight against gentrification is also a fight against police brutality and over-policing of poor communities and communities of color. You know, that a fight against that is also a fight for economic justice and the elimination of poverty in our cities. And so I think one of the things that a focus on food and gentrification offers is the importance of an intersectional analysis, and linking food to a whole array of social movements can really build power in ways that can push our local politicians, our state representatives, and so on, to actually begin implementing the more courageous policies that we need and the more courageous actions that we actually need. Things like, you know, permanent moratoriums on evictions, for example, you know, living wages, encouraging cooperative forms of business ownership, you know, the right to a union, and so on and so forth. And so for me, you know, that's one thing I would like to end on, is that there's a lot of resistance to gentrification, and that, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that grassroots activists are beginning to make a lot of these connections and finding ways to actually change our cities, perhaps in small ways at first, but in ways that lead to greater kind of food justice and housing security.
Thank you. And thanks all of you for taking your time today to sit with me and talk with me about your book. I will go ahead and close out the interview, and I just want to say thanks all and enjoy your break.
Thanks, Aubrey. That's great.
Thanks so much for having us. This has been really fun.
Thanks, Aubrey.